Side 7. Christine. Continuing on page 248. Moochie stood there on the deserted early morning sidewalk, his numb ears poking out from beneath his long hair, his breath pluming frostily on the air. The car sat at the curb facing him, engine growling softly. It was impossible to tell who, if anyone, was behind the wheel. It was parked directly beneath one of the streetlights, and the orange glow burned across the glass of the unmarred windshield like a waterproof jack-o'-lantern seen deep down in dark water. Moochie began to be afraid. He slicked his tongue over dry lips and looked around. To his left was JFK Drive, 6 lanes wide and looking like a dry riverbed at this empty hour of the morning. To his right was a photography shop, orange letters outlined in red spelling Kodak across its window. He looked back at the car. It just sat there, idling. He opened his mouth to speak and produced no sound. He tried again and got a croak. Hey, Cunningham. The car sat, seeming to brood, exhaust curled up. The engine rumbled, idling fat on high-test gas. That you, Cunningham? He took one more step, a cleat scraped on cement. His heart was thudding in his neck. He looked around at the street again. Surely another car would come. JFK Drive couldn't be totally deserted even at 1:25 in the morning, could it? But there were no cars, only the flat orange glare of the streetlights. Moochie cleared his throat. You ain't mad, are you? Christine's duels suddenly came on, pinning him in harsh white light. The fury ripped toward him, peeling out, the tires screaming black slashes of rubber onto the pavement. It came with such sudden power that the rear end seemed to squat like the haunches of a dog preparing to spring, a dog or a she-wolf. The onside wheels jumped up on the pavement, and it ran at Moochie that way. Offside wheels down, onside wheels up over the curb, canted at an angle. The undercarriage scraped and shrieked and shot off a swirling flicker of sparks. Moochie screamed and tried to sidestep. The edge of Christine's bumper barely flicked his left calf and took a chunk of meat. Warm wetness coursed down his leg and puddled in his shoe. The warmth of his own blood made him realize in a confused way just how cold the night was. He thudded hip-first into the doorway of the photo shop, barely missing the plate-glass window. A foot to the left and they would have crashed right through, landing in a litter of Nikons and Polaroid one-steps. He could hear the car's engine suddenly revving up, that horrible, unearthly shrieking of the undercarriage on the cement again. Moochie turned around, panting harshly. Christine was reversing back up the gutter, and as it passed him, he saw, there was no one behind the wheel. Panic began to pound in his head. Moochie took to his heels. He ran out into JFK Drive, sprinting for the far side. There was an alley over there between a market and a dry-cleaning place, too narrow for the car. If he could get in there... Change jingled badly in his pants pockets and in the 5 or 6 pockets of his army surplus duffel coat. Quarters, nickels, dimes. A jingling silver carillon. He pumped his knees almost to his chin. His cleated engineer boots drummed the pavement. His shadow chased him. The car somewhere behind him revved again, fell off, and then the motor began to shriek. The tires wailed, and Christine shot at Moochie Waltz's back, crossing the lanes of JFK Drive at right angles. Moochie screamed and could not hear himself scream because the car was still peeling rubber. The car was still shrieking like an insanely angry, murderous woman, and that shriek filled the world. His shadow was no longer chasing him. It was leading him and getting longer. In the window of the dry-cleaning shop, he saw great yellow eyes blossom. It wasn't even close. At the very last moment, Moochie tried to jig left, but Christine jigged with him as if she had read his final desperate thought. The Plymouth hit him squarely, still accelerating, breaking Moochie Welch's back and knocking him spang out of his engineer's boots. He was thrown 40 feet into the brick siding of the little market, again narrowly missing a plunge through a plate-glass window. The force of his strike was hard enough to cause him to rebound into the street again, leaving a splash of blood on the brick like an ink blot. A picture of it would appear the next day on the front page of the Libertyville Keystone. Christine reversed, screeched to a skidding, sliding stop, and roared forward again. Moochie lay near the curbing, trying to get up. He couldn't get up. Nothing seemed to work. All the signals were scrambled. Bright, white light washed over him. No, he whispered through a mouthful of broken teeth. The car roared forward and over him. Change flew everywhere. Moochie was pulled and rolled first one way and then the other as Christine reversed into the street again. She stood there, engine revving and falling off to a rich idle, then revving again. She stood there as if thinking. Then she came at him again. She hit him, jumped the curb, skidded around, and then reversed again, thumping back down. She screamed forward and back and forward. Her headlights glared, her exhaust pipes jetted hot blue smoke. The thing in the street no longer looked like a human being. It looked like a scattered bundle of rags. The car reversed a final time, skidded around in a half circle, and accelerated, roaring over the bleeding bundle in the street again, and going down the drive, the blast of its engine still winding up to full rev, racketing off the walls of the sleeping buildings, but not entirely sleeping now. Lights were beginning to flick on. People who lived over their stores were going to their windows to see what all the racket had been about, and if there had been an accident. One of Christine's headlights had been shattered. Another flickered unsteadily off and on, bleared with a thin wash of Moochie's blood. The grill had been bent inward, and the dents in it approximated the shape and size of Moochie's torso with all the gruesome perfection of a death mask. Blood was splashed across the hood in fans that spread out as wind speed increased. The exhaust had taken on a heavy blatting sound. One of Christine's two mufflers had been destroyed. Inside on the instrument panel, the odometer continued to run backward, as if Christine were somehow slipping back into time, leaving not only the scene of the hit-and-run behind, but the actual fact of the hit-and-run. The muffler was the first thing. Suddenly that heavy, blatting sound diminished and smoothed out. The fans of blood on the hood began to run toward the front of the car again, in spite of the wind, as if a movie film had been reversed. The flickering headlight suddenly shone steadily, and a tenth of a mile later, the dead light became a headlight again. With an unimportant tinkling sound, no more than the sound of a small boy's boot breaking the thin scum of ice on a mud puddle, the glass reassembled itself from nowhere. There was a hollow punk, punk, punk sound from the front end, the sound of denting metal, the sound you sometimes get when you squeeze a beer can. But instead of denting, Christine's grill was popping back out. A body shop veteran with 50 years' experience in putting fender benders right could not have done it more neatly. Christine turned onto Hampton Street even before the first of those awakened by the screaming of her tires had reached Moochie's remains. The blood was gone. It had reached the front of the hood and disappeared. The scratches were gone. As she rolled quietly toward the garage door with its honk for entry sign, there was one final punk, as the last dimple, this one in the left front bumper, the spot where Christine had struck Moochie's calf, popped back out. Christine looked like new. The car stopped in front of the large garage door in the middle of the dark and silent building. There was a small plastic box clipped to the driver's side sun visor. This was a little doodad Will Darnell had given Arnie when Arnie began to run cigarettes and booze over into New York State for him. It was perhaps Darnell's version of a gold key to the crapper. In the still air, the door opener hummed briefly, and the garage door rattled obediently up. Another circuit was made by the rising door, and a few interior lights came on, burning weakly. The headlight knob on the dashboard suddenly went in, and Christine's duals went out. She rolled inside and whispered across the oil-stained concrete to stall 20. Behind her, the overhead door, which had been set on a 30-second timer, rolled back down. The light circuit was broken, and the garage was dark again. In Christine's ignition switch, the keys, dangling down, suddenly turned to the left. The engine died. The leather patch with the initials RDL branded into it swung back and forth in decreasing arcs and was finally still. Christine sat in the dark, and the only sound in Darnell's do-it-yourself garage was the slow tick of her cooling engine. 31. The day after. I got a 69 Chevy with a 396, fuely heads and a Hurst on the floor. She's waiting tonight down in the parking lot outside the 7-Eleven store. Bruce Springsteen. Arnie Cunningham did not go to school the next day. He said he thought he might be coming down with the flu, but that evening he told his parents that he felt enough improved to go down to Darnell's and do some work on Christine. Regina protested, although she did not come right out and say so. She thought Arnie looked like death warmed over. His face was now entirely free of acne and blemishes, but there was a trade-off. It was much too pale, and there were dark circles under his eyes, as if he hadn't been sleeping. In addition, he was still limping. She wondered uneasily if her son could be using some sort of drug, if perhaps he had hurt his back worse than he had let on, and had started taking pills so he could go on working on the goddamned car. Then she dismissed the thought. Obsessed as he might be with the car, Arnie would not be that stupid. "I'm really fine, Mom," he said. "You don't look fine, and you hardly touched your supper." I'll get some chow later on. How's your back? You're not lifting a lot of heavy stuff down there, are you? No, Mom. This was a lie, and his back had hurt terribly all day long. This was the worst it had been since the original injury at Philly Plains. Oh, is that where it started? His mind whispered. Oh, really? Are you sure? He had taken the brace off for a while, and his back had throbbed fit to kill him. He had put it on again after only 15 minutes, cinching it tighter than ever. Now his back really was a little better, and he knew why. He was going to her, that was why. Regina looked at him, worried and at a loss. For the first time in her life, she simply did not know how to proceed. Arnie was beyond her control now. Knowing it brought on a horrible feeling of despair that sometimes crept up on her and filled her brain with an awful, empty, rotten coldness. At these times, a depression so total she could barely credit it would steal through her, making her wonder exactly what it was she had lived her life for, so her son could fall in love with a girl and a car all in the same terrible fall. Was that it? So she could see exactly how hateful to him she had become when she looked in his gray eyes. Was that it? And it really didn't have anything to do with the girl at all, did it? No. In her mind, it always came back to the car. Her rest had become broken and uneasy. And for the first time since her miscarriage nearly 20 years before, she had found herself considering making an appointment with Dr. Mesia to see if he would give her some pill for the stress and the depression and the attendant insomnia. She thought about Arnie on her long sleepless nights, and about mistakes that could never be rectified. She thought about how time had a way of swinging the balance of power on its axis, and how old age had a way of sometimes looking through a dressing table mirror like the hand of a corpse poking through eroded earth. "Will you be back early?" she asked, knowing this was the last breastwork of the truly powerless parent, hating it, unable now to change it. "Sure," he said, but she didn't much trust the way he said it. "Arnie, I wish you'd stay home. You really don't look good at all." "I'll be fine," he said. "Got to be. I have to run some auto parts over to Jamesburg for Will tomorrow." "Not if you're sick," she said. "That's nearly 150 miles. "Don't worry." He kissed her cheek, the passionless kiss on the cheek of cocktail party acquaintances. He was opening the kitchen door to go out when Regina asked, "Did you know the boy who was run down last night on Kennedy Drive?" He turned back to look at her, his face expressionless. "What?" "The paper said he went to Libertyville." "Oh, the hit and run. That's what you're talking about." "Yes." "I had a class with him when I was a freshman," Arnie said. "I think." "No, I really didn't know him, Mom." "Oh," she nodded, pleased. "That's good. The paper said there were residues of drugs in his system. You'd never take drugs, would you, Arnie?" Arnie smiled gently at her pallid, watchful face. "No, Mom," he said. "And if your back started to hurt you, I mean if it really started to hurt you, you'd go see Dr. Mesia about it, wouldn't you? You wouldn't buy anything from a drug pusher, would you?" "No, Mom," he repeated, and went out. There had been more snow. Another thaw had melted most of it, but this time it had not disappeared completely. It had only withdrawn into the shadows, where it formed a white rime under hedges, the bases of trees, the overhang of the garage. But in spite of the snow around the edges, or maybe because of it, their lawn looked oddly green as Arnie stepped out into the twilight, and his father looked like a strange refugee from summer as he raked the last of the autumn leaves. Arnie raised his hand briefly to his father and made as if to go past without speaking. Michael called him over. Arnie went reluctantly. He didn't want to be late for his bus. His father had also aged in the storms that had blown up over Christine, although other things had undoubtedly played a part. He had made a bid for the chairmanship of the history department at Horlicks late in the summer and had been rebuffed quite soundly. And during his annual October checkup, the doctor had pointed out an incipient phlebitis problem. Phlebitis, which had nearly killed Nixon. Phlebitis, an old folks' problem. As that late fall moved toward another gray western Pennsylvania winter, Michael Cunningham looked gloomier than ever. "Hi, Dad. Listen, I've got to hurry if I'm going to catch..." Michael looked up from the little pile of frozen brown leaves he had managed to get together. The sunset caught the planes of his face and appeared to make them bleed. Arnie stepped back involuntarily, a little shocked. His father's face was haggard. "Arnold," he said, "where were you last night?" "What?" Arnie gaped, then closed his mouth slowly. Why, here. Here, Dad, you know that. All night? Of course, I went to bed at 10 o'clock. I was bushed. Why? Because I had a call from the police today, Michael said. About that boy who was run over on JFK Drive last night. Moochie Welch, Arnie said. He looked at his father with calm eyes that were deeply circled and socketed for all their calmness. If the son had been shocked by the father's appearance, the father was also dully shocked by his son's. To Michael, the boy's eye sockets looked nearly like a skull's vacant orbs in the failing light. The last name was Welch, yes. They would be in touch, I suppose. Mom doesn't know that he might have been one of the guys that trashed Christine. Not from me. I didn't tell her either. I'd be glad if she didn't find that out, Arnie said. She may find it out eventually, Michael said. In fact, she almost certainly will. She's an extremely intelligent woman, in case you've never noticed. But she won't find it out from me. Arnie nodded, then smiled humorlessly. Where were you last night? Your trust is touching, Dad. Michael flushed, but his eyes didn't drop. Maybe if you'd been standing outside yourself these last couple of months, he said, you'd understand why I asked. What the hell does that mean? You know damn well. It hardly even bears discussing anymore. We just go around and around the same old mulberry bush. Your entire life is jittering apart, and you stand there and ask me what I'm talking about. Arnie laughed. It was a hard, contemptuous sound. Michael seemed to shrivel a little before it. Mom asked me if I was on drugs. Maybe you want to check that one out, too. Arnie made as if to push up the sleeves of his warm-up jacket. Want to check for needle tracks? I don't need to ask if you're on drugs, Michael said. You're only on one I know of, and that's enough. It's that goddamn car. Arnie turned as if to go, and Michael pulled him back. Get your hand off my arm. Michael dropped his hand. I wanted you to be aware, he said. I no more think you'd kill someone than I think you could walk across the Simmons swimming pool. But the police are going to question you, Arnie. And people can look surprised when the police turn up suddenly. To them, surprise can look like guilt. All of this because some drunk ran over that shitter Welch? It wasn't like that, Michael said. I got that much out of this fellow Junkins who called me up on the phone. Whoever killed the Welch boy ran him down, and then backed over him and ran over him again and backed up again and... Stop it, Arnie said. He suddenly looked sick and frightened. And Michael had much the same feeling Dennis had had on Thanksgiving evening, that in this tired unhappiness, the real Arnie was suddenly close to the surface, perhaps reachable. It was incredibly brutal, Michael said. That's what Junkins said. You see, it doesn't look like an accident at all. It looks like murder. Murder, Arnie said, dazed. No, I never... What? Michael asked sharply. He grabbed Arnie's jacket again. What did you say? Arnie looked at his father. His face was mask-like again. I never thought it could be that, he said. That's all I was going to say. I just wanted you to know, he said. They'll be looking for someone with a motive, no matter how thin. They know what happened to your car and that the Welch boy might have been involved, or that you might think he was involved. Junkins may be around to talk to you. I don't have anything to hide. No, of course not, Michael said. You'll miss your bus. Yeah, Arnie said. Gotta go. But he stayed a moment longer, looking at his father. Michael suddenly found himself thinking of Arnie's 9th birthday. He and his son had gone to the little zoo in Philly Plains, had eaten lunch out, and had finished the day by playing 18 holes at the indoor miniature golf course on Outer Basin Drive. That place had burned down in 1975. Regina had not been able to come. She had been flat on her back with bronchitis. The two of them had had a fine time. For Michael, that had been his son's best birthday, the one that symbolized for him, above all others, his son's sweet and uneventful American boyhood. They had gone to the zoo and come back, and nothing much had happened except that they had had a great time. Michael and his son, who had been and who still was so dear to him. He wet his lips and said, "Sell her, Arnie, why don't you? When she's completely restored, sell her away. You could get a lot of money, a couple, 3,000 maybe." Again, that frightened, tired look seemed to sweep over Arnie's face, but Michael couldn't tell for sure. The sunset had faded to a bitter orange line on the western horizon, and the little yard was dark. Then the look, if it had been there at all, went away. No, I couldn't do that, Dad, Arnie said gently, as if speaking to a child. I couldn't do that now. I've put too much into her, way too much. And then he was gone, cutting across the yard to the sidewalk, joining the other shadows, and there was only the sound of his footfalls coming back, soon lost. Put too much into her? Have you? Exactly what, Arnie? What have you put into her? Michael looks down at the leaves, then around at his yard. Beneath the hedge and under the overhang of the garage, cold snow glimmered in the coming dark, livid and stubbornly waiting for reinforcements, waiting for winter. 32. Regina and Michael. She's real fine, my 409, my four-speed dual quad positraction 409. The Beach Boys. Regina was tired. She tired more easily these days, it seemed. And they went to bed together around 9, long before Arnie came in. They made love that was dutiful and joyless. Lately they made love a lot. It was almost always dutiful and joyless. And Michael had begun having the unpleasant feeling that his wife was using his penis as a sleeping pill. And as they lay in their twin beds after, Michael asked casually, "How did you sleep last night?" "Quite well," Regina said candidly. And Michael knew she was lying. Good. "I came up around 11 and Arnie seemed restless," Michael said, still keeping his voice casual. He was deeply uneasy now. There had been something in Arnie's face tonight, something he hadn't been able to read because of the damned shadows. It was probably nothing, nothing at all, but it glowed in his mind like a baleful neon sign that simply would not shut off. Had his son looked guilty and scared, or had it just been the light? Unless he could resolve that, sleep would be a long time coming tonight, and it might not come at all. "I got up around 1, Regina said, and then hurried to add, "Just to use the bathroom. I checked in on him." She laughed a little wistfully. "Old habits die hard, don't they?" "Yes," Michael said. "I guess they do." He was sleeping deeply then. I wish I could get him to wear pajamas in cold weather. He was in his skivvies? "Yes." He settled back, immeasurably relieved and more than a little ashamed of himself as well. But it was better to know for sure. It was all very well for him to tell Arnie that he knew the boy could no more commit a murder than he could walk on water. But the mind, that perverse monkey, the mind can conceive of anything and seems to take a perverse delight in doing so. Just maybe, Michael thought, lacing his hands behind his head and looking up at the dark ceiling, just maybe that's the peculiar damnation of the living. In the mind, a wife can rot laughing with a best friend. A best friend can cast plots against you and plan backstabbings. A son can commit murder by auto. Better to be ashamed and put the monkey to sleep. Arnie had been here at 1 o'clock. It was unlikely Regina was mistaken about the time because of the digital clock radio on their bureau. It told the time in numbers that were big and blue and unmistakable. His son had been here at 1 o'clock. And the Welch boy had been run down 3 miles away 25 minutes later. Impossible to believe that Arnie could have dressed, gone out without Regina, who had surely been lying wakeful, hearing him, gone down to Darnell's, gotten Christine, and driven out to where Moochie Welch had been killed. Physically impossible. Not that he had ever believed it to begin with. The mind monkey was satisfied. Michael rolled over on his right side, slept, and dreamed that he and his 9-year-old son were playing miniature golf on an endless series of small, astroturfed greens where windmills turned and tiny water hazards lay in wait. And he dreamed that they were alone, all alone in the world, because his son's mother had died in childbirth. Very sad. People still remarked on how inconsolable Michael had been. But when they went home, he and his son, the house would be theirs alone. They would eat spaghetti right from the pot like a couple of bachelor slobs. And when the dishes were washed, they would sit at a kitchen table hidden beneath spread newspapers and build model cars with harmless plastic engines. In his sleep, Michael Cunningham smiled. Beside him, in the other bed, Regina did not. She lay awake and waited for the sound of the door that would tell her that her son had come in from the world outside. When she heard the door open and close, when she heard his step on the stairs, then she would be able to sleep. Maybe. 33. Junkins. I think you better slow down and drive with me, baby. You say what? Hush up and mind my own business? But, baby, you are my business. You good business, baby. And I love good business. What kind of car am I driving? I'm driving a 48 Cadillac with Thunderbird wings. I tell you, baby, she's a moving thing. Right on, Josephine, right on. Ellis McDaniel. Junkins turned up at Darnell's around 8:45 that evening. Arnie had just finished with Christine for the night. He had replaced the radio antenna that Repperton's gang had snapped off with a new one, and for the last 15 minutes or so he had been sitting behind the wheel, listening to WDIL's Friday night cavalcade of gold. He had meant to do no more than turn the radio on and dial across once, making sure that he had hooked up the antenna plug properly and that there was no static. But he had run onto WDIL's strong signal, and had sat there, looking straight through the windshield, his gray eyes musing and far away, as Bobby Fuller sang, "I Fought the Law," as Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers sang, "Why Do Fools Fall in Love?" As Eddie Cochran sang, "Come on, everybody," and Buddy Holly sang, "Rave on." There were no commercials on WDIL Friday nights, and no DJs, just the sounds. Gone from the charts, but not from our hearts. Every now and then a soothing female voice would break in and tell him what he already knew, that he was listening to WDIL Pittsburgh, the sound of blue suede radio. Arnie sat dreaming behind the wheel, the red idiot lights glowing on the dash, tapping his fingers lightly. The antenna was fine. Yes, he had done a good job. It was like Will said, he had a light touch. Look at Christine. Christine proved it. She had been a hunk of junk sitting on LeBay's lawn, and he had brought her back. Then she had been a hunk of junk sitting in the long-term lot out at the airport, and he had brought her back again. He had... Rave on. Rave on and tell me. Tell me not to be lonely. He had what? Replaced the antenna, yes. And he had popped some of the dents, he could remember that. But he hadn't ordered any glass, although it was all replaced. He hadn't ordered any new seat covers, but they were all replaced too. And he had only looked closely under the hood once before slamming it back down in horror at the damage they had done to Christine's mill. But now the radiator was whole, the engine block clean and glowing, the pistons moving free and clear, and it purred like a cat. But there had been dreams. He had dreamed of LeBay behind the wheel of Christine, LeBay dressed in an army uniform that was spotted and splotched with blue-gray patches of graveyard mold. LeBay's flesh had sloughed and run, white gleaming bone poked through in places. The sockets where LeBay's eyes had once been were empty and dark. But something was squirming in there. Ah, yes, something. And then Christine's headlights had come on and someone had been pinned there, pinned like a bug on a white square of cardboard. Someone familiar. Moochie Welch? Maybe. But as Christine suddenly rocketed forward, tires screaming, it had seemed to Arnie that the terrified face out there on the street ran like tallow, changing even as the Plymouth bore down on it. Now it was Repperton's face, now Sandy Galton's, now it was Will Darnell's heavy moon face. Whoever was out there had jumped aside, but LeBay had thrown Christine into reverse, working the shift lever with black rotting fingers, a wedding ring hung on one as loose as a hoop thrown over the branch of a dead tree. And then he threw it back into drive as the figure raced for the far side of the street. And as Christine bore down again, the head had turned, throwing a terrified glance backward, and Arnie had seen the face of his mother. The face of Dennis Gilder, Lee's face, all eyes under a floating cloud of dark blonde hair, and finally his own face, the twisted mouth forming the words, "No, no, no." Overriding everything, even the heavy thunder of the exhaust, something underneath had been damaged for sure, was LeBay's rotting, triumphant voice coming from a decayed larynx, passing lips that were already shriveled away from the teeth and tattooed with a delicate spidering of dark green mold, LeBay's triumphant, shrieking voice. "Here you go, you shitter. See how you like it." There had been the heavy, mortal thud of Christine's bumper striking flesh, the gleam of a pair of spectacles rising in the night air, turning over and over, and then Arnie had awakened in his room, curled into a trembling ball and clutching his pillow. It had been 2:15 in the morning, and his first feeling had been a great and terrible relief, relief that he was still alive. He was alive, Libby was dead, and Christine was safe, the only three things in the world that mattered. "Oh, but Arnie, how did you hurt your back?" Some voice inside, sly and insinuating, asking a question he was afraid to answer. "I heard it at Philly Plains," he had told everyone. "One of the junkers started to slip back down the ramp of Will's flatbed, and I pushed it back up. Didn't think about it, I just did it. Strained something really bad," so he had said. And one of the junkers had started to slip, and he had pushed it back up. But that hadn't been how he hurt his back, had it? No. That night, after he and Lee had found Christine smashed to hell in the parking lot, sitting on 4 slashed tires, that night at Darnell's, after everyone was gone, he had tuned the radio in Will's office to the oldies on WDIL. Will trusted him now, why not? He was running cigarettes across the state line into New York. He was running fireworks all the way over to Burlington. And twice he had run something wrapped in flat brown paper packages into Wheeling, where a young guy in an old Dodge Challenger traded him another slightly larger brown paper package for it. Arnie thought maybe he was trading cocaine for money, but he didn't want to know for sure. He drove a boat on these trips. Will's private car, a 1966 Imperial, as black as midnight in Persia. It was whisper quiet, and the trunk had a false bottom. If you kept to the speed limit, it was no problem. Why should it be? The important thing was that he now had the keys to the garage. He could come in after everyone else was gone, like he had that night. And he had turned on WDIL, and he had hurt his back somehow. What had he been doing to hurt his back? A strange phrase came to him in answer, floating up from his subconscious. "It's just a funny little glitch." Did he really want to know? He didn't. In fact, there were times when he didn't want the car at all. There were times when he felt he would be better off just, well, junking it. Not that he ever would or could. It was just that sometimes, in the sweaty, shaking aftermath of that dream last night, for instance, he felt that if he got rid of it, he would be happier. The radio suddenly spat an almost feline burst of static. "Don't worry," Arnie whispered. He ran his hand slowly over the dashboard, loving the feel of it. Yes, the car frightened him sometimes. And he supposed his father was right. It had changed his life to some degree, but he could no more junk it than he could commit suicide. The static cleared. The Marvelettes were singing, "Please, Mr. Postman." And then a voice said in his ear, "Arnold Cunningham?" He jumped and snapped off the radio. He turned around. A small, dapper little man was leaning in Christine's window. His eyes were a dark brown, and his color was high from the cold outside, Arnie guessed. "Yes?" "Rudolph Junkins, State Police, Detective Division." Junkins stuck his hand in through the open window. Arnie looked at it for a moment. So his father had been right. He grinned his most charming grin, took the hand, shook it firmly, and said, "Don't shoot, copper. I'll throw out my guns." Junkins returned Arnie's grin, but Arnie noticed that the grin did no more than touch his eyes, which were exploring the car in a quick, thorough fashion that Arnie didn't like, not at all. "Whew, I got the feeling from the local police that the guys who worked over your rolling iron had really tattooed it. It sure doesn't look like it." Arnie shrugged and got out of the car. Friday nights were slow at the garage. Will himself rarely came in, and he wasn't in tonight. Across the way in stall 10, a fellow named Gabs was putting a new muffler on his old Valiant. And down at the far end of the garage, there was the periodic burr of an air wrench as some fellow put on his snow tires. Otherwise, he and Junkins had the place to themselves. "It wasn't anywhere near as bad as it looked," Arnie said. He thought that this smiling, dapper little man might be extremely clever. As if it was a natural outgrowth of the thought, he rested his hand easily on Christine's roof and immediately felt better. He could cope with his man, clever or not. After all, what was there to worry about? There was no structural damage. "Huh? I understood they punched holes in the body with some sharp instrument," Junkins said, looking closely at Christine's flank. "I'll be damned if I can see the fill. You must be a bodywork genius, Arnie. The way my wife drives, maybe I ought to put you on retainer. He smiled disarmingly, but his eyes went on running back and forth over the car. They would dart momentarily to Arnie's face and then go back to the car again. Arnie liked it less and less. I'm good, but not God, Arnie said. You can see the bodywork if you really look for it. He pointed at a minute ripple in Christine's back deck. And there, he pointed at another. I was lucky enough to find some original Plymouth body parts up in Ruggles. I replaced the entire back door on this side. You see the way the paint doesn't quite match? He knocked his knuckles on the door. Nope, Junkins said. I might be able to tell with a microscope, Arnie, but it looks like a perfect match to me. He also knocked his knuckles on the door. Arnie frowned. Hell of a job, Junkins said. He walked slowly around to the front of the car. Hell of a job, Arnie. You're to be congratulated. Thanks. He watched as Junkins, in the guise of the sincere admirer, used his sharp brown eyes to look for a suspicious dents, flaked paint, maybe a spot of blood or a snarl of matted hair, looking for signs of Moochie Welch. Arnie was suddenly sure that was just what the shitter was doing. What exactly can I do for you, Detective Junkins? Junkins laughed. Man, that's formal. I can't take that. Make it Rudy, okay? Sure, Arnie said, smiling. What can I do for you, Rudy? You know, it's funny, Junkins said, squatting to look at the driver's side headlights. He tapped one of them reflectively with his knuckles, and then, with seeming absent-mindedness, he ran his forefinger along the headlight's semicircular metal hood. His overcoat pooled on the oil-stained cement floor for a moment. Then he stood up. We get reports on anything of this nature. The trashing of your car, I mean. Oh, hey, they didn't really trash it, Arnie said. He was beginning to feel as if he was on a tightrope, and he touched Christine again. Her solidity, her reality, once more seemed to comfort him. They tried, you know, but they didn't do a very good job. Okay, I guess I'm not up on the current terminology, Junkins laughed. Anyway, when it came to my attention, what do you think I said? Where's the photographs? That's what I said. I thought it was an oversight, you know. So I called the Libertyville PD, and they said there were no photographs. No, Arnie said. A kid my age can't get anything but liability insurance, you know that. Even the liability comes with a $700 deductible. If I had damage insurance, I would have taken plenty of pictures, but since I didn't, why would I? I sure wouldn't want them for my scrapbook. No, I guess not, Junkins said, and walked idly around to the rear of the car, eyes searching for broken glass, for scrapes, for guilt. But you know what else I thought was funny? You didn't even report the crime. He raised his dark, questioning eyes to Arnie's, looked at him closely, and then smiled a phony, bewildered little smile. Didn't even report it. Huh, I said, son of a bitch, who reported it? Guy's father, they tell me. Junkins shook his head. I don't get that, Arnie, I don't mind telling you. The guy works his ass off restoring an old car until it's worth $2,000, maybe $5,000. Then some guys come along and beat the hell out of it. I told you. Rudy Junkins raised his hand and smiled disarmingly. For one weird second, Arnie thought he was going to say peace, as Dennis sometimes did when things got heavy. Damaged it, sorry. Sure, Arnie said. Anyhow, according to what your girlfriend said, one of the perpetrators, defecated on the dashboard. I would have thought you would have been mad as hell. I would have thought you would have reported it. Now the smile faded altogether, and Junkins looked at Arnie soberly, even sternly. Arnie's cool gray eyes met Junkins' brown ones. Shit wipes off, he said finally. You want to know something, Mr. Rudy? You want me to tell you something? Sure, son. When I was 1 1/2, I got hold of a fork and marked up an antique bureau that my mother had saved up for over a period of maybe 5 years. Saved up her pin money, that's what she said. I guess I racked the hell out of it in a very short time. Of course, I don't remember it, but she says she just sat right down and bawled. Arnie smiled a little. Up until this year, I couldn't feature my mother doing that. Now I think I can. Maybe I'm growing up a little. What do you think? Junkins lit a cigarette. Am I missing the point, Arnie, because I don't see it yet? She She said that she would rather have had me in diapers until I was 3 than have had me do that. Because, she said, shit wipes off. Arnie smiled. You flush it away and it's gone. The way Moochie Welch is gone? Junkins asked. I know nothing about that. No? No. Scout's honor? Junkins asked. The question was humorous, but the eyes were not. They probed at Arnie, looking for the smallest break, a crucial flicker. Down the aisle, the fellow who had been putting on his winter snows dropped a tool on the concrete. It clanged musically, and the fellow chanted almost chorally, Oh, shit on you, you whore. Junkins and Arnie both glanced that way briefly, and the moment was broken. Sure, Scout's honor, Arnie said. Look, I suppose you have to do this. It's your job. Sure, it's my job, Junkins agreed softly. The boy was run over 3 times each way. He was meat. They scraped him up with a shovel. Come on, Arnie said sickly. His stomach did a lazy barrel roll. Why, isn't that what you're supposed to do with shit? Scrape it up with a shovel? I had nothing to do with it, Arnie cried, and the man across the way who had been tinkering with his muffler looked up, startled. Arnie lowered his voice. I'm sorry. I just wish you'd leave me alone. You know damn well I didn't have anything to do with it. You just went over the whole car. If Christine had hit that Welch kid that many times and that hard, it would be all busted up. I know that much just from watching TV. And when I was taking Auto Shop 1 2 years ago, Mr. Smolnack said that the 2 best ways he knew to totally destroy a car's front end was to either hit a deer or a person. He was joking a little, but he wasn't kidding, if you know what I mean. Arnie swallowed and heard a click in his throat, which was very dry. Sure, Junkins said. Your car looks all right. But you don't, kid. You look like a sleepwalker. You look absolutely fucked over. Pardon my French. He flicked his cigarette away. You know something, Arnie? What? I think you're lying faster than a horse can trot. He slapped Christine's hood. Or maybe I should say faster than a Plymouth can run. Arnie looked at him, his hand on the outside mirror on the passenger side. He said nothing. I don't think you're lying about killing the Welch boy. But I think you're lying about what they did to your car. Your girl said they mashed the crap out of it. And she's a hell of a lot more convincing than you are. She cried while she told me. She said there was broken glass everywhere. Where did you buy replacement glass, by the way? McConnell's, Arnie said promptly, in the Berg. Still got the receipt? Tossed it out. But they'll remember your big order like that. They might, Arnie said, but I wouldn't count on it, Rudy. They're the biggest auto glass specialists west of New York and east of Chicago. That covers a lot of ground. They do yay business in a lot of its old cars. Still, they'll have the paperwork. I paid cash. But your name will be on the invoice. No, Arnie said, and smiled a wintry smile. Darnell's do-it-yourself garage. That way I got a 10% discount. You got it all covered, don't you? Lieutenant Junkins, you're lying about the glass, too, although I'll be goddamned if I know why. You'd think Christ was lying on Calvary, that's what I think, Arnie said angrily. Since when is it a crime to buy replacement glass if someone busts up your windows, or pay cash, or get a discount? Since never, Junkins said. Then leave me be. More important, I think you're lying about not knowing anything about what happened to the Welch boy. You know something. I want to know what. I don't know anything, Arnie said. What about, I don't have anything more to say to you, Arnie said. I'm sorry. All right, Junkins said, giving up so quickly that Arnie was immediately suspicious. He rummaged around in the sport coat he was wearing under his topcoat and took out his wallet. Arnie saw that Junkins was carrying a gun in a shoulder holster and suspected Junkins had wanted him to see it. He produced a card and gave it to Arnie. I can be reached at either of those numbers, if you want to talk about anything, anything at all. Arnie put the card in his breast pocket. Junkins took one more leisurely stroll around Christine. Hell of a restoration job, he repeated. He looked squarely at Arnie. Why didn't you report it? Arnie let out a low, shuddering sigh. Because I thought that would be the end, he said. I thought they'd let off. Yeah, Junkins said. I thought that might be it. Good night, son. Good night. Junkins started away, turned, came back. Think it over, he said. You really do look like hell, you know what I mean? You have a nice girl there. She's worried about you, and she feels bad about what happened to your car. Your dad's worried about you, too. I could get that even over the phone. Think it over and then give me a call, son. You'll sleep better. Arnie felt something trembling behind his lips. Something small and tearful, something that hurt. Junkins's brown eyes were kind. He opened his mouth. God alone knew what might have spilled out. And then a monstrous jab of pain walloped him in the back, making him straighten suddenly. It also had the effect of a slap on a hysteric. He felt calmer, clear-headed again. Good night, he repeated. Good night, Rudy. Junkins looked at him a moment longer, troubled, and then left. Arnie began to shake all over. The trembling started in his hands and spread up his forearms to his elbows, and then it was suddenly everywhere. He grabbed blindly for the door handle, found it at last, and slipped into Christine, into the comforting smells of car and fresh upholstery. He turned the key to accessory. The idiot lights glowed, and he felt for the radio dial. As he did so, his eyes fell on the swinging leather tab with RDL branded into it, and his dream recurred with sudden terrible force, the rotting corpse sitting where he was sitting now, the empty eye socket staring out through the windshield, the finger bones gripping the wheel, the empty grin of the skull's teeth as Christine bore down on Moochie Welch while the radio, turned to WDIL, played Last Kiss by J. Frank Wilson and the Cavaliers. He suddenly felt sick, puking sick. Nausea fluttered sickeningly in his stomach and in the back of his throat. Arnie scrambled out of the car and ran for the head, his footfalls hammering crazily in his ears. He just made it. Everything came up. He vomited again and again until there was nothing left but sour spit. Lights danced in front of his eyes. His ears rang and the muscles in his gut throbbed tiredly. He looked at his pale, harried face in the spotty mirror, at the dark circles under his eyes and the lank spill of hair across his forehead. Junkins was right. He looked like hell. But his pimples were all gone. He laughed crazily. He wouldn't give Christine up, no matter what. That was the one thing he wouldn't do. And suddenly he had to do it again, only there was nothing left to come up, only ripping, clenching, dry heaves and that electric taste of spit in his mouth again. He had to talk to Lee. Quite suddenly, he had to talk to Lee. He let himself into Will's office, where the only sound was the thump of the time clock bolted on the wall, turning up fresh minutes. He dialed the Cabot's number from memory, but miscued twice because his fingers were trembling so badly. Lee herself answered, her voice sounding sleepy. Arnie? I have to talk to you, Lee. I have to see you. Arnie, it's almost 10 o'clock. I just got out of the shower and into bed. I was almost asleep. Please, he said, and shut his eyes. Tomorrow, she said. It can't be tonight. My folks wouldn't let me out so late. It's only 10, and it's Friday. They really don't want me to see so much of you, Arnie. They liked you at first, and my dad still does, but they both think you've gotten a little spooky. There was a long, long pause at Lee's end. I think you have, too, she said finally. Does that mean you don't want to see me any more? He asked dully. His stomach hurt, his back hurt, everything hurt. No. Now the faintest reproach crept into her voice. I was kind of getting the idea that you didn't want to see me. Not at school, and nights you're always down there at the garage, working on your car. That's all done, he said. And then, with a monstrous effort, it's the car I want to... Ow, God damn it! He grabbed at his back, where there had been another huge bolt of pain, and got only a handful of back brace. Arnie? She was alarmed. Are you all right? Yeah, I had a twinge in my back. What were you going to say? Tomorrow, he said. We'll drive over to Baskin-Robbins and have an ice cream and maybe do some Christmas shopping and have some supper and I'll have you home by 7. And I won't be weird, I promise. She laughed a little, and Arnie felt a great, sweeping relief. It was like balm. You dummy. Does that mean okay? Yes, it means okay. Lee paused and then said softly, I said my parents didn't want me to see so much of you. I didn't say I wanted that. Thanks, he said, struggling to keep his voice steady. Thanks for that. What do you want to talk to me about? Christine, I want to talk to you about her and about my dreams and about why I look like hell and why I always want to listen to WDIL now and about what I did that night after everyone was gone, the night I hurt my back. Oh, Lee, I want another slash of pain up his back like cat's claws. I think we just talked about it, he said. Oh, a slight warm pause. Good. Lee? There'll be more time now, I promise, all the time you want. And thought, because now with Dennis in the hospital, you're all that's left. All that's left between me and... That's good, Lee said. I love you. Goodbye, Arnie. Say it back, he wanted to shout suddenly. Say it back, I need you to say it back. But there was only the click of the phone in his ear. He sat behind Will's desk for a long time, head lowered, getting hold of himself. She didn't need to say it back every time he said it to her, did she? He didn't need reassurance that badly, did he? Did he? Arnie got up and went to the door. She was coming out with him tomorrow. That was the important thing. They would do the Christmas shopping they had been planning on the day those shitters trashed Christine. They would walk and talk. They would have a good time. She would say she loved him. She'll say it, he whispered, standing in the doorway. But halfway down the left-hand side of the garage, Christine sat like a mute and stupid denial, her grill poking forward as if hunting something. And the voice whispered out of his lower consciousness, the dark, questioning voice, How did you hurt your back? How did you hurt your back? How did you hurt your back, Arnie? It was a question he shrank from. He was afraid of the answer. 34. Lee and Christine. My baby drove up in a brand new Cadillac. She said, Hey, come here, Daddy. I ain't never coming back. Baby, won't you hear my plea? Come on, sugar, come on back to me. She said, Balls to you, Big Daddy. I ain't never coming back. The clash. It was a gray day, threatening snow, but Arnie was right on both counts. They had a good time, and he wasn't weird. Mrs. Cabot had been at home when Arnie got there, and her initial reception was cool. But it was a long time, perhaps 20 minutes, before Lee came downstairs, wearing a caramel-colored sweater that clung lovingly to her breasts, and a new pair of cranberry-colored slacks that clung lovingly to her hips. This inexplicable lateness in a girl who was almost always perfectly on time might have been on purpose. Arnie asked her later, and Lee denied it with an innocence that was perhaps just a little too wide-eyed, but in any case, it served its purpose. Arnie could be charming when he had to be. And he went to work on Mrs. Cabot with a will. Before Lee finally came bouncing downstairs, twisting her hair into a ponytail, Mrs. Cabot had thawed. She had gotten Arnie a Pepsi-Cola and was listening raptly as he regaled her with tales of the chess club. It's the only civilized extracurricular activity I've ever heard of, she told Lee, and smiled approvingly at Arnie. Boring, Lee trumpeted. She put her arm around Arnie's waist and smacked him loudly on the cheek. Lee Cabot. Sorry, Mums, but he looks cute in lipstick, doesn't he? Wait a minute, Arnie, I've got a Kleenex. Don't claw at it. She dug in her purse for a tissue. Arnie looked at Mrs. Cabot and rolled his eyes. Natalie Cabot put a hand to her mouth and giggled. The rapprochement between her and Arnie was complete. Arnie and Lee went to Baskin-Robbins, where an initial awkwardness, left over from the phone conversation of the night before, finally melted away. Arnie had a vague fear that Christine would not run well, or that Lee would find something nasty to say about her. She had never liked riding in his car. Both were needless worries. Christine ran like a fine Swiss watch, and the only things Lee had to say about her rang of pleasure and amazement. I never would have believed it, she said as they drove out of the ice cream parlor's small parking lot and joined the flow of traffic headed toward the Monroeville Mall. You must have worked like a dog. It wasn't as bad as it probably looked to you, Arnie said. Mind some music? No, of course not. Arnie turned on the radio. The silhouettes were kip-kipping and boom-booming through Get a Job. Lee made a face. D-I-L, yuck, can I change it? Be my guest. Lee switched it to a Pittsburgh rock station and got Billy Joel. You may be right, Billy admitted cheerfully. I may be crazy. This was followed by Billy telling his girl Virginia that Catholic girls started much too late. It was the block party weekend. Now, Arnie thought, now she'll start to hitch, back off, something. But Christine only went rolling along. The mall was thronged with hectic but mostly good-natured shoppers. The last frantic and sometimes ugly Christmas rush was better than 2 weeks off. The Yuletide spirit was still new enough to be novel, and it was possible to look at the tinsel strung through the wide mall hallways without feeling sour and Ebenezer Scroogey. The steady ringing of the Salvation Army Santa's bells had not yet become a guilty annoyance. They still chanted good tidings and goodwill, rather than the monotonous, metallic chant of "The poor have no Christmas, the poor have no Christmas, the poor have no Christmas," that Arnie always seemed to hear as the day grew closer and both the shop girls and the Salvation Army Santas grew more harried and hollow-eyed. They held hands until the parcels grew too many for that, and then Arnie complained good-naturedly about how she was turning him into her beast of burden. As they were going down to the lower level, and B. Dalton, where Arnie wanted to look for a book on toy-making for Dennis Gilder's old man, Lee noticed that it had begun to snow. They stood for a moment at the window of the glassed-in stairwell, looking out like children. Arnie took her hand, and Lee looked at him, smiling. He could smell her skin, clean and a bit soapy. He could smell the fragrance of her hair. He moved his head forward a bit. She moved hers a bit toward him. They kissed lightly, and she squeezed his hand. Later, after the bookstore, they stood above the rink in the center of the mall, watching the skaters as they dipped and pirouetted and swooped to the sound of Christmas carols. It was a very good day, right up until the moment that Lee Cabot almost died. She almost surely would have died, if not for the hitchhiker. They had been on their way back then, and an early December twilight had long since turned to snowy dark. Christine, sure-footed as usual, purred easily through the 4 inches of fresh, light powder. Arnie had made a reservation for an early dinner at the British Lion Steakhouse, Libertyville's only really good restaurant, but the time had gotten away from them, and they had agreed on a quick-to-go meal from the McDonald's on JFK Drive. Lee had promised her mother she would be in by 8:30 because the Cabots were having friends in, and it had been 7:45 when they left the mall. Just as well, Arnie said. I'm damn near broke anyway. The headlights picked out the hitchhiker standing at the intersection of Route 17 and JFK Drive, still 5 miles outside of Libertyville. His black hair was shoulder length, speckled with snow, and there was a duffel bag between his feet. As they approached him, the hitchhiker held up a sign painted with day-glow letters. It read, Libertyville, Pennsylvania. As they drew closer, he flipped it over. The other side read, Non-Psycho College Student. Lee burst out laughing. Let's give him a ride, Arnie. Arnie said, When they go out of their way to advertise their non-psychotic status, that's when you got to look out. But okay. He pulled over. That evening, he would have tried to catch the moon in a bushel basket if Lee had asked him to give it a shot. Christine rolled smoothly to the verge of the road, tires barely slipping. But as they stopped, static blared across the radio, which had been playing some hard rock tune, and when the static cleared, there was the big bopper singing Chantilly Lace. What happened to the block party weekend? Lee asked as the hitchhiker ran toward them. I don't know, Arnie said, but he knew. It had happened before. Sometimes all that Christine's radio would pick up was WDIL. It didn't matter what buttons you pushed or how much you fooled with the FM converter under the dashboard, it was WDIL or nothing. He suddenly felt that stopping for the hitchhiker had been a mistake. But it was too late for second thoughts now. The fellow had opened one of Christine's rear doors, tossed his duffel bag onto the floor, and slipped in after it. A blast of cold air and a swirl of snow came in with him. Ah, man, thanks. He sighed. My fingers and toes all took off for Miami Beach about 20 minutes ago. They must have gone somewhere anyway, because I sure can't feel them anymore. Thank my lady, Arnie said shortly. Thank you, ma'am, the hitchhiker said, tipping an invisible hat gallantly. Don't mention it, Lee said, and smiled. Merry Christmas. Same to you, the hitchhiker said, although you'd never know there was such a thing if you'd been standing out there trying to hook a ride tonight. People just breeze by, and then they're gone. Boom. He looked around appreciatively. Nice car, man. Hell of a nice car. Thanks, Arnie said. You restore it yourself? Yeah. Lee was looking at Arnie, puzzled. His earlier expansive mood had been replaced by a curtness that was not like his usual self at all. On the radio, the Big Bopper finished, and Richie Valens came on doing La Bamba. The hitchhiker shook his head and laughed. First the Big Bopper, then Richie Valens. Must be Death Night on the radio. Good old WDIL. What do you mean? Lee asked. Arnie snapped the radio off. They died in a plane crash with Buddy Holly. Oh, Lee said in a small voice. Perhaps the hitchhiker also sensed the change in Arnie's mood. He fell silent and meditative in the back seat. Outside, the snow began to fall faster and harder. The first good storm of the season had come in. At length, the golden arches twinkled up out of the snow. "Do you want me to go in, Arnie?" Lee asked. Arnie had gone nearly as quiet as stone, turning aside her bright attempts at conversation with mere grunts. "I will," he said and pulled in. "What do you want?" "Just a hamburger and French fries, please." She had intended to go the whole hog, Big Mac, shake, even the cookies, but her appetite seemed to have shrunk away to nothing. Arnie parked. In the yellow light flaring from the squat brick building's undersides, his face looked jaundiced and somehow diseased. He turned around, arm trailing over the seat. "Can I grab you something?" "No, thanks," the hitchhiker said. "Folks will be waiting supper. Can't disappoint my mom. She kills the fatted calf every time I come home." The chunk of door cut off his final word. Arnie had gotten out and was headed briskly across to the inn door, his boots kicking up little puffs of new snow. "Is he always that cheery?" the hitchhiker asked. "Or does he get sort of taciturn sometimes?" "He's very sweet," Lee said firmly. She was suddenly nervous. Arnie had turned off the engine and taken the keys, and she was left alone with this stranger in the back seat. She could see him in the rearview mirror, and suddenly his long black hair, tangled by the wind, his scruff of beard, and his dark eyes made him seem Manson-like and wild. "Where do you go to school?" she asked. Her fingers were plucking at her slacks, and she made them stop. "Pitt," the hitchhiker said, and no more. His eyes met hers in the mirror, and Lee dropped hers hastily to her lap. Cranberry red slacks. She had worn them because Arnie had once told her he liked them, probably because they were the tightest pair she owned, even tighter than her Levi's. She suddenly wished she had worn something else, something that could be considered provocative by no stretch of the imagination. A grain sack, maybe. She tried to smile. It was a funny thought, all right. A grain sack, get it? Ha ha ho ho, what a knee slapper. But no smile came. There was no way she could keep from admitting it to herself. Arnie had left her alone with this stranger as punishment. It had been her idea to pick him up. And now she was scared. "Bad vibes," the hitchhiker said suddenly, making her actually catch her breath. His words were flat and final. She could see Arnie through the plate glass window standing fifth or sixth in line. He wouldn't get up to the counter for a while. She found herself imagining the hitchhiker suddenly clamping his gloved hands around her throat. Of course she could reach the horn ring, but would the horn sound? She found herself doubting it for no sane reason at all. She found herself thinking that she could hit the horn 99 times and it would honk satisfyingly, but if on the 100th she was being strangled by this hitchhiker on whose behalf she had interceded, the horn wouldn't blow. Because Christine didn't like her. In fact, she believed that Christine hated her guts. It was as simple as that. Crazy, but simple. Pardon me? She glanced back in the rearview mirror and was immeasurably relieved to see that the hitchhiker wasn't looking at her at all. He was glancing around the car. He touched the seat cover with his palm, then lightly brushed the roof upholstery with the tips of his fingers. "Bad vibes," he said and shook his head. "This car, I don't know why, but I get bad vibes." "Do you?" she asked, hoping her voice sounded neutral. "Yeah. I got stuck in an elevator once when I was a little kid. Ever since then, I get attacks of claustrophobia. I never had one in a car before, but boy, I got one now, in the worst way. I think you could light a kitchen match on my tongue. That's how dry my mouth is." He laughed a short, embarrassed laugh. "If I wasn't already so late, I'd just get out and walk. No offense to you or your guy's car," he added hastily, and when Lee looked back into the mirror, his eyes did not seem wild at all, only nervous. Apparently he wasn't kidding about the claustrophobia, and he no longer looked like Charlie Manson to her at all. Lee wondered how she could have been so stupid, except she knew how and why. She knew perfectly well. It was the car. All day long, she had felt perfectly okay riding in Christine, But now her former nervousness and dislike were back. She had merely projected her feelings onto the hitchhiker because you could be scared and nervous about some guy you just picked up off the road, but it was insane to be scared by a car, an inanimate construct of steel and glass and plastic and chrome. That wasn't just a little eccentric. It was insane. You don't smell anything, do you? He asked abruptly. Smell anything? A bad smell. No, not at all. Her fingers were plucking at the bottom of her sweater now, pulling off wisps of angora. Her heart was knocking unpleasantly in her chest. It must be part of your claustrophobia, what's this? I guess so. But she could smell it. Under the good new smells of leather and upholstery, there was a faint odor. Something like gone-over eggs. Just a whiff. A lingering whiff. Mind if I crank the window down a little? If you won't, Lee said, and found it took some effort to keep her voice steady and casual. Suddenly, her mind's eye showed her the picture that had been in the paper yesterday morning, a picture of Moochie Welch, probably culled from the yearbook. The caption beneath read, Peter Welch, victim of fatal hit-and-run incident that police feel may have been murder. The hitchhiker unrolled his window 3 inches, and crisp, cold air came in, driving that smell away. Inside McDee's, Arnie had reached the counter and was giving his order. Looking at him, Lee experienced such an odd swirl of love and fear that she felt nauseated by the mixture. For the second or third time lately, she found herself wishing that she had fixed on Dennis first. Dennis, who seemed so safe and sensible. She turned her thoughts away from that. Just tell me if it gets cold on you, the hitchhiker said apologetically. I'm weird, I know it. He sighed. Sometimes I think I never should have given up drugs, you know? Lee smiled. Arnie came out with a white bag, skidded a little in the snow, and then got behind the wheel. Cold like an icebox in here, he grunted. Sorry, man, the hitchhiker said from the back and rolled the window up again. Lee waited to see if that smell would come back, but now she could smell nothing but leather, upholstery, and the faint aroma of Arnie's aftershave. Here you go, Lee. He gave her a burger, fries, and a small Coke. He had gotten himself a Big Mac. Want to thank you again for the ride, man, the hitchhiker said. You can just drop me off at the corner of JFK and Center, if that's cool. Fine, Arnie said shortly, and pulled out. The snow was coming down even more heavily now, and the wind had begun to whoop. For the first time, Lee felt Christine scared a bit as she felt for a grip on the wide street, which was now almost deserted. They were less than 15 minutes from home. With the smell gone, Lee discovered that her appetite had come back. She wolfed half of her hamburger, drank some Coke, and stifled a burp with the back of her hand. The corner of Center and JFK, marked with a war memorial, came up on the left, and Arnie pulled over, pumping the brakes lightly so Christine wouldn't slide. Have a nice weekend, Arnie said. He sounded more like his usual self now. Maybe all he needed was some food, Lee thought, amused. Same goes to both of you, the hitchhiker said, and have a Merry Christmas. You too, Lee said. She took another bite of her hamburger, chewed, swallowed, and felt it lodge halfway down her throat. Suddenly, she couldn't breathe. The hitchhiker was getting out. The noise of the door opening was very loud. The sound of the latch clicking sounded like the thud of tumblers falling in a bank vault. The sound of the wind was like a factory whistle. This is stupid, I know, but I can't, Arnie, I can't breathe. I'm choking, she tried to say, and what came out was a faint, fuzzy sound that she was sure the whine of the wind must have covered. She clawed at her throat, and it felt swollen and throbbing in her hand. She tried to scream. No breath to scream. No breath. Arnie, I can't. At all. And she could feel it in there, a warm lump of burger and bun. She tried to cough it up, and it wouldn't come. The dashboard lights, bright green, circular. Cat like the eyes of a cat. Dear God, I can't breathe. Watching her. God, I can't breathe, can't breathe, can't. Her chest began to pound for air. Again, she tried to cough up the lump of half-chewed burger and bun in her throat, but it wouldn't come. Now the sound of the wind was bigger than the world, bigger than any sound she had ever heard before, and Arnie was finally turning away from the hitchhiker to look at her. He was turning in slow motion, his eyes widening almost comically, and even his voice seemed too loud, like thunder. The voice of Zeus speaking to some poor mortal from behind a massive sky stack of thunderclouds. Lee, are you? What the hell? She's choking. Oh, my God, she's... He reached for her in slow motion, and then he drew his hands back, immobilized by panic. Oh, help me, for God's sake, do something, I'm dying. Oh, my dear God, I'm choking to death on a McDonald's hamburger. Arnie, why don't you help me? And of course she knew why. He drew back because Christine didn't want her to have any help. This was Christine's way of getting rid of her. Christine's way of getting rid of the other woman, the competition. And now the dashboard instruments really were eyes, great, round, unemotional eyes, watching her choke to death. Eyes she could see only through a growing jitter of black dots, dots that burst and spread as, "Mama, oh my dear, this, I'm dying, and she sees me, she is alive, 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 oh Mama, my God, Christine is alive." Arnie reached for her again. Now she had begun to thrash on the seat, her chest heaving spasmodically as she clawed at her throat. Her eyes were bulging, her lips had begun to turn blue. Arnie was pounding her ineffectually on the back and yelling something. He grabbed her shoulder, apparently meaning to pull her out of the car, and then he suddenly winced and straightened, his hands going involuntarily to the small of his back. Lee twitched and thrashed. The blockage in her throat felt huge and hot and throbbing. She tried again to cough it up, more weakly this time. The lump didn't budge. Now the whistle of the wind was beginning to fade. Everything was beginning to fade, but her need for air didn't seem so awful. Maybe she was dying. But suddenly it didn't seem so bad. Nothing was so bad, except for those green eyes staring at her from the instrument panel. They weren't unemotional anymore. Now they were blazing with hate and triumph. "Oh, my God, I am heartily sorry for having offended thee. I am for offending. This is my act of... Arnie had reached across from the driver's side. Now Lee's door was suddenly jerked open and she spilled sideways into a brutal cutting cold. The air partially revived her, made her struggle for breath seem important again. But the obstruction wouldn't move. It just wouldn't move. From far away, Arnie's voice thundering sternly, the voice of Zeus. "What are you doing? Get your hands off her!" Arms around her, strong arms, the wind on her face, snow swirling in her eyes. "Oh, my God, hear me, a sinner. This is my act of contrition. I am heartily sorry for having offended. Oh, ow! What are you doing? My ribs hurt. What are you..." And suddenly there were arms around her, crushing, and a pair of hard hands were clasped together in a knot just below her breasts, in the hollow of her solar plexus. And suddenly one thumb popped up, the thumb of a hitchhiker signaling for a ride, only the thumb drove painfully into her breastbone. At the same time, the grip of the arms tightened brutally. She felt caught. "Oh, you're breaking my ribs!" In a gigantic bear hug. Her whole diaphragm seemed to heave, and something flew out of her mouth with the force of a projectile. It landed in the snow, a wet chunk of bun and meat. "Let her go!" Arnie was shouting as he slipped and slid around Christine's rear deck to where the hitchhiker held Lee's limp body like a life-sized marionette. "Let her go! You're killing her!" Lee began to breathe in great, tearing gasps. Her throat and lungs seemed to burn in rivers of fire with each gulp of the cold, wonderful air. She was dimly aware that she was sobbing. The brutal bear hug relaxed and the hands let her go. "Are you okay, girl? Are you all?" Then Arnie was reaching past her, grabbing for the hitchhiker. He turned toward Arnie, his long black hair flying in the wind, and Arnie hit him in the mouth. The hitchhiker flailed backward, boots slipping in the snow, and landed on his back. Fresh snow was fine and dry as confectioner's sugar puffed up around him. Arnie advanced, fists held up, eyes slitted. She took another convulsive breath. Oh, it hurt. It was like being stabbed with knives, and screamed, "What are you doing, Arnie? Stop it!" He turned toward her, dazed. "Huh, Lee? He saved my life. What are you hitting him for?" The effort was too much, and the black dots began to spiral up before her eyes again. She could have leaned against the car, but she didn't want to go near it, didn't want to touch it. The dashboard instruments. Something had happened to the dashboard instruments. Something. Eyes. They turned into eyes. She didn't want to think about. She staggered to a lamppost instead and hung onto it like a drunk, head down, panting. A soft, tentative arm went around her waist. "Lee, honey, are you all right?" She turned her head slightly and saw his miserable, scared face. She burst into tears. The hitchhiker approached them carefully, wiping his bloody mouth on the sleeve of his jacket.
"Thank you,"
Lee said between harsh, swift breaths. The pain was ebbing a trifle now, and the hard, cold wind was soothing on her hot face.
"I was choking. I think I would have died if you hadn't..."
"Too much. The black dots again. All sounds fading into an eerie wind tunnel again." She put her head down and waited for it to pass.
"It's the Heimlich maneuver," the hitchhiker said. "They make you learn it when you go to work in the cafeteria at school. Make you practice on a rubber dummy. Daisy May, they call her. And you do it, but you don't have any idea if it'll, you know, work on a real person or not."
His voice was shaky, jumping in pitch from low to high and back to low again, like the voice of a kid entering puberty. His voice seemed to want to laugh or cry, something. And even in the uncertain light and heavily falling snow, Lee could see how pallid his face was.
"I never thought I'd actually have to use it. Works pretty good. Did you see that fucking piece of meat fly?" The hitchhiker wiped his mouth and looked blankly at the thin froth of blood on the palm of his hand.
I'm sorry I hit you, Arnie said. He sounded close to tears. I was...
Sure, man, I know. He clapped Arnie on the shoulder. No harm, no foul. Girl, are you all right?
Yes,
Lee said. Her breath was coming evenly now. Her heart was slowing down. Only her legs were bad. They were so much helpless rubber. My God, she thought. I could be dead now. If we hadn't picked that guy up, and we almost didn't... It occurred to her that she was lucky to be alive. This cliché struck her forcibly with a stupid, undeniable power that made her feel faint. She began to cry harder. When Arnie led her back toward the car, she came with him, her head on his shoulder. Well, the hitchhiker said uncertainly, I'll be off.
Wait, Lee said, what's your name? You saved my life. I'd like to know your name.
Barry Gottfried, the hitchhiker said, at your service. Again, he swept off an imaginary hat.
Lee Cabot, she said, this is Arnie Cunningham. Thank you again.
For sure, Arnie added. But Lee heard no real thanks in his voice, only that shakiness. He handed her into the car, and suddenly the smell assaulted her, attacked her. Nothing mild this time, much more than just a whiff underneath. It was the smell of rot and decomposition, high and noxious. She felt a mad fright invade her brain, and she thought, it is the smell of her fury. The world slipped sideways in front of her. She leaned out of the car and threw up. Then everything there went gray for a little while.
Are you sure you're all right? Arnie asked her for what seemed to be the 100th time.
It would also have to be for one of the last, Lee realized with some relief. She felt very, very tired. There was a dull, throbbing pain in her chest, and another one at her temples.
I'm fine now.
Good, good. He moved irresolutely, as if wanting to go, but not sure it would be right yet. Perhaps not until he had asked his seemingly eternal question at least once more. They were standing in front of the Cabot house. Oblongs of yellow light spilled from the windows and lay smoothly on the fresh and unmarked snow. Christine stood at the curb, idling, showing parking lights.
You scared me when you fainted like that, Arnie said.
I didn't faint, I only got fogged in for a few minutes. Well, you scared me. I love you, you know. She looked at him gravely. Do you?
Of course I do. Lee, you know I do.
She drew in a deep breath. She was tired. But it had to be said, and said right now, because if she didn't say it now, what had happened would seem completely ridiculous by morning light, or maybe more than ridiculous. By morning light, the idea would likely seem mad. A smell that came and went like a moldering stench in a gothic horror story, dashboard instruments that turned into eyes, and most of all, the insane feeling that the car had actually tried to kill her. By tomorrow, even the fact that she had almost choked to death would be nothing but a vague ache in her chest and the conviction that it had been nothing, really, not a close call at all. Except it was all true, and Arnie knew it was. Yes, some part of him did, and it had to be said now. Yes, I think you do love me, she said slowly. She looked at him steadily. But I won't go anywhere with you again in that car. And if you really love me, you'll get rid of it. The expression of shock on his face was so large and so sudden that she might have struck him in the face.
What are you talking about, Lee?
Was it shock that had caused that slapped expression, or was some of it guilt?
You heard what I said.
I don't think you'll get rid of it. I don't know if you even can anymore. But if you want to go someplace with me, Arnie, we go on the bus, or thumb a ride, or fly. But I'm never going to ride in your car again. It's a death trap. There, she had said it. It was out. Now the shock on his face was turning to anger. The blind, obdurate sort of anger she had seen on his face so frequently lately. Not just over the big things, but over the little ones as well. A woman going through a traffic light on the yellow, a cop who held up traffic just before it was their turn to go. But it came to her now with all the force of a revelation that his anger, corrosive and so unlike the rest of Barney's personality, was always associated with the car, with Christine.
If you love me, you'll get rid of it, he repeated. You know who you sound like?
No, Arnie.
My mother, that's who you sound like.
I'm sorry. She would not allow herself to be drawn.
Neither would she defend herself with words or end it by just going into the house. She might have been able to if she didn't feel anything for him, but she did. Her original impressions that behind the quiet shyness, Arnie Cunningham was good and decent and kind and maybe sexy as well, had not changed much. It was the car, that was all. That was the change. It was like watching a strong mind slowly give way under the influence of some evil, corroding, addictive drug. Arnie ran his hands through his snow-dusted hair, a characteristic gesture of bewilderment and anger. You had a bad choking spell in the car. Okay, I can understand that you don't feel great about it, but it was the hamburger, Lee, that's all. Or maybe not even that. Maybe you were trying to talk while you were chewing or inhaled at just the wrong second or something. You might as well blame Ronald McDonald. People choke on their food every now and then, that's all. Sometimes they die. You didn't. Thank God for that. But to blame my car? Yes, it all sounded perfectly plausible, and was, except that something was going on behind Arnie's gray eyes, a frantic something that was not precisely a lie, but rationalization, a willful turning away from the truth. Arnie, she said, I'm tired and my chest hurts and I've got a headache and I think I've only got the strength to say this once. Will you listen? If it's about Christine, you're wasting your breath, he said, and that stubborn, mulish look was on his face again. It's crazy to blame her, and you know it is. Yes, I know it's crazy, and I know I'm wasting my breath, Lee said, but I'm asking you to listen. I'll listen. She took a deep breath, ignoring the pull in her chest. She looked at Christine, idling a plume of white vapor into the thickly falling snow, then looked hastily away. Now it was the parking lights that looked like eyes, the yellow eyes of a lynx. When I was choking, the instrument panel, the lights on it changed. They changed. I won't go that far, but they looked like eyes. He laughed, a short bark in the cold air. In the house, a curtain was pulled aside, someone looked out, and then the curtain dropped back again. If that hitchhiker, that Gottfried fellow, if he hadn't been there, I would have died, Arnie. I would have died. She searched his eyes with her own and pushed ahead. Once, she told herself, I only have to say this once. You told me that you worked in the cafeteria at LHS your first 3 years. I've seen the Heimlich maneuver poster on the door to the kitchen. You must have seen it, too. But you didn't try that on me, Arnie. You were getting ready to clap me on the back. That doesn't work. I had a job in a restaurant back in Massachusetts, and the first thing they teach you, even before they teach you the Heimlich maneuver, is that clapping a choking victim on the back doesn't work. What are you saying? He asked in a thin, out-of-breath voice. She didn't answer, only looked at him. He met her gaze for only a moment, and then his eyes, angry, confused, almost haunted, shifted away. Lee, people forget things. You're right, I should have used it. But if you had the course, you know you can use it on yourself. Arnie laced his hands together into a fist, with one thumb sticking up and pressed against his diaphragm to demonstrate. It's just that in the heat of the moment, people forget. Yes, they do, and you seem to forget a lot of things in that car, like how to be Arnie Cunningham. Arnie was shaking his head. You need time to think this over, Lee. You need... That is just what I don't need, she said with a fierceness she wouldn't have believed she still had left in her. I never had a supernatural experience in my life. I never even believed in stuff like that. But now I wonder just what's going on and what's happening to you. They looked like eyes, Arnie. And later, afterward... There was a smell, a horrible, rotten smell. He recoiled. You know what I'm talking about. No, I don't have the slightest idea. You just jumped as if the devil had twisted your ear. You're imagining things, Arnie said hotly, a lot of things. That smell was there. And there are other things as well. Sometimes your radio won't get anything but that oldie station. Another flicker in his eyes and a slight twitch at the left corner of his mouth. And sometimes when we're making out, it just stalls as if it didn't like it. As if the car didn't like it, Arnie. You're upset, he said with ominous flatness. Yes, I am upset, she said, beginning to cry. Aren't you? The tears trickled slowly down her cheeks. I think this is the end of it for us, Arnie. I loved you, but I think it's over. I really think it is. And that makes me feel so sad and so sorry. Your relationship with your parents has turned into an armed camp.
You're running God knows what into New York and Vermont for that fat pig Will Darnell? And that car? That car?
She could not say anything more. Her voice dissolved. She dropped her packages and bent blindly to pick them up. Exhausted and weeping, she succeeded in doing little more than stirring them around. He bent to help her, and she pushed at him roughly. Leave them alone. I'll get them. He stood up, his face pale and set. His expression was one of wooden fury, but his eyes... Oh, to Lee, his eyes seemed lost. All right, he said, and now his voice roughened with his own tears. Good. Join up with the rest of them if you want. You just saddle up and ride right along with all those other shitters. Who gives a tin shit? He drew in a shivering breath, and a single hurt sob escaped him before he could clap a gloved hand brutally over his mouth. He began to walk backward toward the car. He reached out blindly behind himself for the Plymouth, and Christine was there. Just as long as you know you're crazy, right out of your mind. So go on and play your games. I don't need you. I don't need any of you. End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.